I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The showdown between Russia and the U.S. and NATO over Ukraine shows no signs of cooling off. Russia has stationed more than 100,000 troops along the border with Ukraine, while the Pentagon has put 8,500 U.S. troops on alert for possible deployment to Eastern Europe. NATO countries are also readying their respective militaries. The Biden administration is sending military weapons to Ukraine and has ordered the families of American staff at the U.S. Embassy to leave the country because of heightened tensions. President Biden said yesterday he would be willing to impose personal sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Representatives of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France are meeting in Paris today to try to jumpstart peace talks. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Zelensky told his country not to panic. We are at a critical juncture in this crisis, and we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Angela Stent is senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Putin's World. She joins us by Skype. And Angela Stent, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back on your show.
Nice to have you back on our show. And also with us is Melinda Herring. She's deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. Previously, she was the editor of the Atlantic Council's popular publication, the Ukraine Alert blog. And Melinda Herring, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Mary. I love WHYY, so it's a real pleasure.
Oh, that's great. And it's Marty, but that's okay. No worries. We have a lot to talk about, but let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation with any questions or comments. Well, let me begin with, I guess, the most basic question that hangs over this crisis, which is, what does Vladimir Putin want? Does he want to annex Ukraine? Does he want to cause instability in the region? Does he want to contain NATO? Does he want to restart the Cold War? Does he want to reconstitute the Soviet Union? Angela Stent, let me just toss that to you. How do you see Putin's moves and maneuvers?
So right now, this is what we see now has been nearly 30 years in the making, really. What Putin wants to do is to reorder the European security system as it was created in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because he feels that Russia doesn't have a stake in it, that it was excluded from it. And he believes that Russia has a right to a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. And he's gone so far now in the demands that have been presented to NATO and the United States to say that it also should have a say on what happens in Poland and in Hungary and in other Central European countries. So Ukraine is the immediate crisis. Of course, he wants to really control Ukraine in many ways to prevent it from moving closer to the West, but he's much more ambitious than that. He wants to, as I say, reorder the European security system as it now is.
And Melinda, how do you see it?
I think Angela nailed it. So at first, I thought this was just about Ukraine, because Putin has a lot of emotional reasons. He wants to keep Ukraine in his quote-unquote sphere of influence. He wants to keep a buffer between Russia in the West. But it's a lot more than that. Vladimir Putin is using Ukraine as a lever. The immediate crisis is there now, but he wants to humiliate the West. He wants to tear NATO apart. He wants to end the westernizing project in Ukraine. That is one of the goals. And he wants to make the United States look weak and impotent. And he may get away with it. That's why this is such a big deal right now.
Well, indeed. And let me just pick up on what you both said. But Melinda, I'll start with you. So if those are his intentions, does he invade Ukraine? Does he just maintain 100,000 plus Russian troops along the border of Ukraine? What are his next moves as you see them?
So, Marty, there's a big debate right now in the expert community, and we've been having this debate for a while. Half of us think that it's a big ruse. He's trying to scare us. He has 127,000 troops, Russian troops, surrounding Ukraine on three sides. And he's got a huge number of artillery. I mean, it's a very, very dire situation. And he's trying to get the best deal at the negotiating table that he can get. I don't buy that. I'm part of the other group that thinks it's game time and that Putin may go in. There's at least five different reasons why he might do it. The most compelling are that he can. He has a huge amount of international reserves right now, and he sees weakness everywhere in Europe, in America, in Ukraine. And the you know, he if he wants to take Ukraine, there's never been a better time for him to strike. He also sees support for NATO growing in Ukraine. So more than 58% of Ukrainians support NATO membership. Putin's also annoyed that he hasn't been able to get a deal with Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky's the president of Ukraine. He was elected in 2019. He didn't have any political experience at all. So Putin said, "My God, I'm going to be able to trick this man." And Zelensky is clever, and he held the line, and he won't stop talking about NATO. He came here in September, and it was NATO, NATO, NATO. Hmm. So that's another reason why he's annoyed. There's also the emotional, historical connection between Russia and Ukraine. So Putin has been busy. Last July, he wrote a 5,000-word essay about how Ukraine is not a real country, and Russia's historic lands sit in Ukraine. Now, this wasn't just a one-off essay. There's been many, many more essays that have been written since from Putin, from Dmitry Medvedev, the former president and prime minister of Ukraine, also Vladislav Surkov, who's the one of his sort of ideological henchmen is how I describe him. So this is increasing bellicose rhetoric coming out of Moscow that says that Ukraine is not a real country. And you know what? Looking back 6 months after this stuff has been written, it feels very much like Putin has been making the case for war within Russia. He's been trying to justify what he may do. We don't know if he's going to do it. And then finally, I'd say Putin is thinking about his legacy. He's not a young man. He's an aging autocrat, and he wants to go down in the Russian history books as a great Russian leader. And if you want to be a great Russian leader, you take big swaths of land. So he got Crimea, but that's not enough to go down as a great Russian leader. When he talks about who he admires Stalin and Ivan the Great. So those are all the reasons that I think Putin may go in this time.
We should say again, he went in 2014. To you, Angela Stend, which camp are you in? I'm also, if Melinda is correct that he's going to go in, where does that leave the United States? Where does that leave NATO? Are we about to see some kind of warfare in Europe again?
Well, so at the moment, you know, if he's sitting in the Kremlin, he must be laughing. He has all of the West scurrying around. I mean, since the ultimatums were delivered on December 17th, the two treaties demanding that Ukraine never join NATO and also that NATO retreat to its military posture that it had before it first enlarged in the 1990s, in other words, to where it was when the Soviet Union collapsed. Since that's happened, he's gotten a Zoom meeting with President Biden. We've had a Secretary of State meet with Foreign Minister Lavrov. We had three sets of talks a couple of weeks ago. Right now, the French and the Germans, the Russians, the Ukrainians are meeting. And so there's been this hive of activity. You know, everyone's very concerned. He has us all off balance, which is what he loves to do. So the argument for no reinvasion now is that you know, if they drag this out and the more worried people get, we've mobilized, you know, troops. If we need to send them, we're sending more assistance to the Ukrainians. We're threatening sanctions. But we're already showing cracks, right? All Europeans do not necessarily agree with us about the kind of sanctions we might impose were there a military incursion, another invasion of Ukraine. And so Putin's also sitting there, because one of his major goals, in addition to what I said in the beginning, is to get the United States out of Europe. And as Melinda says, you know, the U.S. looks, we're divided, we're polarized. I don't have to tell you that. The Europeans sort of look similar. The new German government doesn't really know what to do. So the argument for that would be, if you wait long enough and you have everyone off balance and there are also domestic problems within Ukraine and President Zelensky's popularity has fallen. So just sit there and watch everything sort of fall apart. But I am afraid that I'm inclined to believe that there will be some kind of military incursion. Melinda talked about the 5,000-word essay. All the troops are reading that now, right? So they're being taught to believe that this Ukraine is part of Russia, and they're just taking back what rightfully belongs to Russia. And Putin does want to go down as a historic gatherer of the lands, as they say in Russian history, taking back territories. And he wants to come out of that with the West treating Russia as if it were the Soviet Union, a large, great power to be respected and to be feared, and that we wouldn't interfere with what he believes is rightly his. So, and I think my final thing on this is, we talk about another invasion. But there are different ways that this could happen. So you could have a limited territorial military action back in the Donbas region, which is the center of fighting now. This war has been going on for 8 years, and you take a little more territory. You do some more things there. Or it's more expansive. And you try and rebuild this Nova Russia, this statelet, if you like, in southeastern Ukraine. Or, of course, you go full-on invasion and you go to Kyiv, the capital, although it's not clear that there are enough troops assembled yet to do that. So I think there are different scenarios for some kind of military incursion, or it could be cyber. It could be other things that the Russians do without actually starting another war. And again, we don't know what that will be. But I am inclined to believe that there probably will be some military action. Because I take that very seriously.
Well, I hear you both on the same page here. I hear a little echo as well. Let me go back to you, Melinda. We're about 2 minutes from a break here. The United States is not going to leave Europe, correct? And Biden has talked about, putting on some sanctions. We are sending military weapons to Ukraine. Biden even talked about putting personal sanctions on Putin. Is that enough to try to contain this crisis?
No, it's absolutely not. That's a great question, Marty. So Biden said he's going to do three things. He's going to throw the meanest, nastiest package of sanctions that Russia has ever seen. And when I talk to my sanctions experts at the Atlantic Council, the current package of sanctions that the U.S. has on Russia for what it did in Ukraine in 2014 and so forth is about a 2 or a 3 on a 10-point scale. The new package of sanctions that President Biden and his team have put together and done a really good job of getting the European allies on board with is probably an 8 or 9. So it's pretty serious. He also said that we're going to ramp up defensive materiel to Ukraine. And as you said, we're doing that now.
Right.
And he also said that there would be increased NATO forces in Eastern Europe, and NATO's starting to move things around now, but it's not enough. So what's really important to focus on is not the number of troops. Yesterday, President Biden said he might send 8,500 U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Don't focus on the number. Focus on capabilities. And there's a really interesting thing that I'm watching. So Biden has said no boots on the ground, but he hasn't ruled out using U.S. ships and planes. So if we send the right air and naval capabilities now, we may be able to deter Putin.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Melinda Herring. She's deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. Also with us, Angela Stent, senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Putin's World. And we are talking about Putin's ambitions today on Radio Times. As you probably know, more than 100,000 troops are stationed along the border between Russia and Ukraine. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests about the crisis over Ukraine. Here's President Biden speaking yesterday to reporters, again emphasizing the intensity of the situation along the border and the potential NATO response.
There will be enormous consequences if he were to go in and invade, as he could, the entire country, or a lot less than that as well, for Russia, not only in terms of economic consequences and political consequences, but it'll be enormous consequences worldwide. This would be the largest, if he were to move in with all those forces, would be the largest invasion since World War II. It would change the world.
Well, let me go back to you, Angela Stent, and both you and Melinda Herring are essentially saying the same thing, which is it looks like we are on the cusp of some kind of conflict in Ukraine. And it sounds like you're both describing it in maybe a 21st century shooting war. But Angela Stent, what kind of enormous consequence do you think the U.S. and NATO has in response to that kind of Russian aggression?
Well, I mean, if there's a really full-scale invasion, and even if there is a major invasion which doesn't necessarily take Russian troops to Kiev, it's still really unsettling the entire post-war, post-Cold War security system. Mm-hmm. It would have enormous repercussions for Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine itself and then Ukraine's neighbors, the Baltic states, Poland, other Central European states. It really would put an end to the vision that we had in the West after the Soviet Union collapsed of a Europe whole and free. And it could have major repercussions. I mean, Putin is sitting on one of the reasons he's doing it now. I mean, there are a number of reasons that we've already discussed, is because the oil and gas market is very tight. Europe gets up to 40% of its gas supplies from Russia. He's got an energy lever that he can turn on or off. You know, in an extreme scenario, he could turn that tap off, although, of course, he'd lose the revenues. That would be a disaster, obviously, for Europe. But there will be, you know, repercussions of this really throughout Europe. And it will really, it'll unsettle the whole system. So it's about Ukraine's obviously independence and sovereignty, but it's really about a peaceful order in Europe that would be shattered by a significant military incursion.
Well, and I was reading today that the U.S. is at least making some kind of steps to provide fuel, I guess, to Europe in the case of losing access to Russian oil and gas. Let me go to you, Melinda Herring. Both of you have talked about NATO. Does NATO want Ukraine to be part of the alliance?
Marty, that's a great question. So this is the awkward story that no one wants to discuss. We have to go back to 2008, and we need to go back to Bucharest. So there was a meeting there about whether Ukraine and Georgia could join NATO. And they were told that the door is open, but they were never given anything specific. And in my view, this has caused enormous problems and enormous resentment. And if we had made a different decision, if we, the West, had made a different decision in 2008, the world would look very different now. And Putin would not be doing what he's doing. Oh. So a lot of this goes back to the poor decision that was made in 2008 not to give Ukraine and Georgia a real plan to get into NATO.
Let me read an email from Laura, and I'll put this to you, Angela Stent. Laura says, I've been wondering if Putin's saber-rattling at the Ukraine border might be a distraction from some other as-yet-unknown malfeasance, because if he were going to invade, he probably would have done so. Do you think there are domestic calculations at work here, Angela?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, because there's some people, including Russians that I know, who think that this is all a distraction, and Putin may be planning some other big event or planning kind of more serious saber rattling in terms of these new hypersonic nuclear weapons that Russia has developed. And in fact, we do know that Putin likes to surprise people. He is, after all, a judo champion. He was a judo champion as a young man. And so we may all be so focused on Ukraine that we'll be shocked and surprised when something else happens. You know, domestically, his popularity rating has fallen, but it's still 62 or 63%, at least according to official public opinion polls, which is any of our Western politicians would be very happy to have such an approval rating. But, you know, there are economic problems in Russia, and there's a younger generation that doesn't see why it should have to have the same old rulers. Putin's about to turn 70. He can stay in office legally till 2036. I mean, he could probably stay as long as he wanted. And so there's restiveness in the country, and there's been great repression in the last year. So it could be, this is also part of sort of ensuring, you know, that his rule lasts. And pleasing those around him who are calling for a more militant policy.
Here's an email from John. I'll put this to you, Melinda. John says, wouldn't it be viable if Zelensky, he of course is the Ukrainian president, would just step down and let Russia place a president that they wish to save so that they could save some bloodshed, a war, and needless killing? I mean, is that even an option on the table?
Absolutely not. So What we need to get our head around is how much Ukraine has changed since 2014. 2014 is one of those pivotal points in world history and in Ukraine. What happens is In 2013, Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, said he was going to sign a association agreement with the European Union. It's the most boring thing on earth. It's a trade agreement. But he backed out, Marty, and that enraged the country. He went with a Moscow version of the agreement instead. So young people started to come to Kiev, and they said, we want to be part of Europe. We are European. We want to study in Europe. We want to work in Europe. We see ourselves as part of the European story, not part of Vladimir Putin's story. And violence was used against students, and the protests grew and grew and grew. And just to summarize it, in February of 2014, Yanukovych flees after many, many days of protests, very, very intense. He flees to Moscow, and eventually they hold elections, and Ukraine has changed massively since that pivotal point. Ukraine, if you look at any of the opinion polling, Ukrainians want to join the European Union, and they want to join NATO as well. And there's a new sense of civic identity. I travel to Ukraine really frequently, about four times a year, and it's really remarkable. So before, historians always used to talk about an east-west divide, Russian-speaking, Ukrainian-speaking, Orthodox, Catholic. It's not that way anymore. It's not that simplistic. So people are proud to be Ukrainian. More people use the Ukrainian language intentionally. People are Ukrainians first. They're not Jews. They're not Crimean Tatars. They're not Ukrainian, or they're not Russian anymore. There's this new identity that's bubbled up. So if Russia, one of the scenarios, your reader is right, or your listener is right, one of the scenarios Moscow is considering is coming in and putting a pro-Russian puppet in power. It will not work. And this is where I think the Russians might screw up. Russia thinks that it understands Ukraine better than it does. Moscow does not understand how much Kiev has changed in the last 8 years. They've been fighting a war for their independence. And there's no way on God's green earth that they would allow a pro-Russian leader to take over. Could they do it if they brought in a force, if they brought the Air Force? You know, absolutely. Russia can do anything it wants in Ukraine, but it cannot hold Ukraine. And there's a strong, strong history of insurgency and patriotism, and Putin knows that. And that's one of the things that holds him back from a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So he's not going to try to take the entire country. The most maximalist thing that he would consider is going from Kharkiv in the north, try to take Kiev, try to take Dnipro, Odessa. It's about a third of the country. Whoa. There's a river that runs through Ukraine. So if he's feeling maximalist, he's going to try to take everything from the east of the river. But I cannot see, fathom how he would go west of the river. The geography changes, and there's, again, the fighting would be far too strong.
That is Melinda Herring. She's Deputy Director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. Also with us is Angela Stent. She's Senior Non-Resident Fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of a book called Putin's World, and we are talking about the crisis in Ukraine. And joining us now is Mary Kalinya. She is a Ukrainian-American and organizer for the Philadelphia Stands with Ukraine event and rally set to take place this Sunday. And Mary, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. I should say it's been a number of years, and we were talking about Ukraine last time you were on the show.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here. Sorry about the circumstances.
Well, indeed. I mean, this is a very serious situation. You still have family in Ukraine. What do you hear from them?
I have very close family. My parents were refugees from Ukraine after World War II, so I still have first cousins, nephews, and so forth. My nephew actually is in the military. He's in the Army. And, you know, we're terrified. I mean, this is a painful and frightening time with, you know, you can imagine with 100,000 troops on your country's border. You know, I feel every time I turn on the radio, my blood pressure goes up several points. And as you said, this has been going on for a long time. I was on your show in 2014, yep, almost exactly to the date. I think it was early in February. And so, in a way, this is not a new situation, but an escalation, an intensification. Since I was on your show, 14,000 Ukrainian people have been killed in this war because there is an ongoing war. It may not be on the front pages every day, but it's been going on. And there's 1.5 million refugees within the country, internally displaced from their homes, their land, towns have been destroyed, airports, infrastructure, and so forth. So this is an ongoing situation now threatening to become even worse.
Mary, I was talking with our guests about, you know, the possible options that Putin has. Do you think he will invade Ukraine?
I don't know what is in Putin's mind. I mean, I think, you know, I think there's a lot of psychological issues going on there. But there's, you know, one of the themes that runs through is this kind of big lie that Russia has been perpetrating, that Ukraine is not a real country. The Ukrainian language is not real. The Ukrainian people are not a real people, that it's part of Russia. And that, that basically, you know, that we're all brothers. Well, you don't invade and kill your brother, you know, even if, you know, if it was true. And historically, there's a lot of inaccuracies there. So, you know, and it's also not a civil war. This is another lie that's being perpetrated. It is not a civil war. As your guests have been talking about, the strength of Ukrainian feeling has increased dramatically since 2014, which has been increased, I would add, by the fact that, Russia has invaded Crimea and occupied Crimea and has been, you know, making incursions into the east. So they've, in fact, done everything to alienate their so-called brother. And what happens, we don't know. But we know what we have to do, which is to support our family, our friends, our sisters and brothers in Ukraine. And that's why we're having an event here on Sunday, along with other representatives from Eastern European and other communities, to show that we hear you people in Ukraine, we support you, we stand with you, and to show our own government that Ukraine matters to the American people for all the reasons that your guests have described to Europe and to the world.
And Mary, when and where on is that taking place, your rally?
Yes, Sunday. It's going to be at 2 p.m. at the bottom of the steps at the Art Museum. And we have people coming also from the Georgian, Belarusian, Polish, Lithuanian, Latvian, Jewish communities. We're thankful to Councilman David O's office for helping us with some of the logistics. And we're also having statements and maybe even representatives from some of our other elected officials. And this is happening all across the U.S., not just in Philadelphia. There have already been events in New York. Things are happening in Washington, Boston, and most other large cities.
Well, I appreciate you joining us once again. I'm sorry we have to revisit this crisis in Ukraine. But Mary Kalinina, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. She's a Ukrainian-American, and as she mentioned, one of the organizers for the Philadelphia Stands with Ukraine event and rally, Sunday, 2 o'clock, on the steps of the Art Museum. Angela, let me pick up, and actually to you, Melinda, pick up on what Mary was saying about why Americans should care about what's happening in Ukraine. And I wonder, Angela, if you could respond to that.
Well, if we are a country that believes in democracy, in freedom, in people's right to self-determination, these are all things we believe in, then I think we should be very concerned. This is a country which has a very difficult history. Most countries in that region have a difficult history, but Ukraine does have a very difficult history. You know, during the Stalin period, there was an intentional genocide carried out on Ukrainian people, starving them to death. And they, you know, they've come through that. They've been trying to establish a kind of viable state, and they, in fact, are one of the few countries, you know, in the post-Soviet space where you don't know who's going to win the election, which isn't true for most of those post-Soviet countries. So we should be supporting them, but it is more than that, because if Russia is able, you know, if there's some invasion, if they take over Ukraine, if they try and put in a pro-Russian government, who knows where they'll stop? And as we've been saying, it really would cause great instability in a much wider swath of Europe. And so for the reasons that have to do with what's happening inside Ukraine, but the broader environment there, we really should be concerned about what's happening there and do what we're doing, which is supporting Ukraine.
Melinda, let me actually read a question from Stuart, who says Ukraine is clearly divided, roughly 50% support for the West, 50% support for the East. Is there an argument to be made for self-governance of those living in the East who wish to be governed by the East and not the West? I mean, this is an argument to essentially split the country in two. Is that a workable solution?
No, it's not a workable solution, and I don't think that polling is accurate. I think that's old polling. Look, there are some people in the East who either want to be left alone or they might want to be part of something that's independent. This is a very thorny question, and it needs to be worked out. But the majority of Ukrainians want to be part of Ukraine.
And I'm assuming, you know, I've never been to Ukraine. I mean, I looked on a map. It's a large country that even if there are divisions, is it divided, Melinda, geographically or more, you know, just sort of people's sentiments about Russia or Ukraine or Europe?
So, Marty, we got to get you on an airplane.
Ukraine
is my favorite city. Kyiv is my favorite city. I live there, and I went there to teach English and be a freelance writer. And I went there intending to stay for 6 months, and I fell in love, and I couldn't leave. So I stayed for another year and a half. And it is remarkable in terms of its architecture. It has got great food and warm hospitality, and it's stunningly beautiful. So please get on an airplane as soon as you can. Before 2014, so this is a pivotal period, like I said, sure. The Euromaidan period. Ukraine was you could sort of speak of different regions of the East and West. So the East broadly was Russian speaking and more Russian Orthodox. The West was Ukrainian speaking and Catholic. And the South was a different animal. It was Russian speaking, and Odessa's a pretty Jewish city. You know, there's different differences that you could point out. Crimea, the boot that Russia now occupies, has a large Crimean Tatar population. So you know, there were differences you could speak about. Broadly speaking, those differences. There are real differences still, but they're much, much more minimized. So, like I said before, there's a real sense of patriotism in the East. The majority of Ukrainian soldiers who are fighting are from Eastern Ukraine. They're not from Western Ukraine. So that sort of defies the stereotype that it's just, you know, Ukrainian nationalists. And that's one of
I got to jump in only because we're up on a break. We'll be back after a very short break talking about the crisis in Ukraine. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about the escalating conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which of course involves the United States and NATO, what Vladimir Putin wants, the options facing the U.S. and NATO, and what this all means for Ukraine. Talking with Angela Stent, again, senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Putin's World. And Melinda Herring is with us as well, deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And you can join us. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just throw something else in on into our conversation. And Angela Stent, I'll toss this to you. Do you think Ukraine was hurt by President Trump trying to pull that country into the 2020 election, wanting to get, quote unquote, dirt on Joe Biden?
Definitely. I mean, that really was the last thing. You had the new president, Zelensky, as we said, a former TV actor with very little experience, but really wanting to move Ukraine in a better direction. And then coming under this intense pressure from the Biden administration, or from the president, at least himself, withholding assistance to Ukraine unless they dug up some dirt on Joe Biden. The last thing that the Ukrainians needed was to be dragged into the highly polarized politics that was taking place in the United States. Now, fortunately, obviously, we've come beyond that. President Biden has a lot of experience in dealing with Ukraine, but I think, you know, there are still scars from that, and I think a certain wariness in Ukraine about not wanting to be dragged into our own, you know, political mess here, if you like. And so that was not helpful.
Well, here's a related question from Judy. I'll put this to you, Melinda. She says, I was always concerned about Trump giving away classified information to Putin. What do you think about all Putin gained when Trump was president?
What do you think? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Well, I guess her question is really, she's concerned that Trump gave away information either about maybe Ukraine, but also about the United States to Putin, and that has empowered Putin in some way. Do you agree with that?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm not part of the intelligence community, and I don't have, I would only be speculating, honestly. So I don't think that's what the discussion is about. I think Angela nailed it when she said that if Vladimir Putin wins in Ukraine, it's going to fundamentally change Europe, but it's also going to have implications for your listeners in Philadelphia. And I don't mean to sound hysterical, but the rest of the world is watching what happens in Ukraine. And if Putin gets his way in Ukraine, Xi is going to start doing nasty things in the South China Sea. He's looking at Taiwan. If Putin gets a green light, other authoritarians are going to feel very empowered. And it's going to be an ugly, nasty world where might makes right. That's why we got to get this right.
Well, picking up on that, and I'll go back to you, Angela Sten. So is the United States, is NATO, are they entirely helpless against Russian aggression?
Well, they're not entirely helpless, but the bottom line is, and the president himself has said this, the United States is not going to go to war with Russia because then, you know, we could have a nuclear catastrophe. We're not going to send American troops to fight Russian troops. This hasn't happened. You know, we managed to avoid this during the Cold War, and it would be, you know, a disaster if we did it now in 2022. So we're doing what we can. Reinforcing, helping Ukraine, supplying them with lethal defensive weapons, having these troops on standby to go to places like Poland or the Baltic states to shore up their defenses. But there is a limit to how much we can do. Mm-hmm. I go back to an interview that President Obama gave, recalling what had happened in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and then started this war in southeastern Ukraine, which is that Ukraine matters more to Russia. It's an existential question, as Russia defines it, than it does either to Ukraine's neighbors or to the United States. And that it's a very difficult fact of life to accept. But there's an imbalance here. And since Ukraine is not a member of NATO, there really is a limit to what NATO can do to fend off a Russian attack.
But there's a lot more that U.S. could be doing now.
Go ahead, Melinda. So what would that be?
So if I were talking to President Biden, I would suggest that he get on an airplane as soon as possible and go rally Europe around a unified position in opposition to Russian aggression. Angela said earlier that we see some wobbliness, especially on the German side. Biden needs to be in Europe. Zoom is not enough. We know that. So he needs to get on a plane and he needs to bring a short-term plan for renewed American troop deployments to Europe. He's doing that now. And like I said before, don't focus on the number, focus on the military capabilities. And then he needs to bring a long-term plan to end Europe's dependence on Russian gas. And he needs to kill the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Germany to Russia. That would be a big deal. He also, though, needs to appoint a freaking ambassador to Ukraine. There's no excuse for this. We do not have an ambassador in Ukraine. We have a capable DCM, but we have to have an ambassador there. And then the third thing that Biden should do, he needs to go to the UN and make this a big deal. Yes, Russia and China will shoot everything down, but the world needs to know what's happening. So President Biden needs to make the resolution of this crisis a top priority. And he's starting to get the message. So he and his administration really didn't want to focus on Russia. They wanted to, quote unquote, park Russia and ignore it and focus on climate change, COVID, and other concerns. And you know, that's not the way foreign policy works. And Vladimir Putin doesn't like to be ignored. So I think the Biden administration is waking up and they realize the severity of this threat.
Let me go back to you, Angela Stent. Representatives from Ukraine, Russia, Germany, France, they are actually meeting in Paris today. Is diplomacy still an option or is that dead?
I think we have to continue with the diplomacy. We can't give that up. So what you have today is a meeting of the so-called Normandy format, which has been in existence really since 2015, when an agreement was signed called Minsk II, which was supposed to regulate and end the conflict in the Donbas region. Now, since then, very little has happened with this agreement. The Russians and Ukrainians disagree on the sequencing of Russia, you know, pulling its troops back and Ukraine giving some measure of autonomy to these two entities that the Russians have helped separatists establish. So they're going to try and move forward. This is a more limited example of the broader problems in Ukraine. They're going to try and make some progress. The last thing I heard was that they've all said, yes, they're you know, coming up with a better formula. We have to try diplomacy. We can't give up. Now, the Russians are waiting for a formal reply to the two treaties, I would call them ultimatums, that they presented to the United States and NATO in December. I have a pretty good idea what the reply will look like if you listen to what our officials have been saying, which is we are willing to discuss with the Russians measures to improve security in Europe, and that could have to do with medium-range missile deployments, with troop movements, things like that. There are areas where we can talk to the Russians and maybe come to some agreement. But the U.S. and the Europeans are not going to cede the two, you know, vital points of Ukraine's ability to join NATO should one day that be a possibility. And it's really not on the horizon at the moment. And the second one is, again, pulling out all NATO troops and hardware from the new members of NATO, starting with the first enlargement in 1999. So I think this process will continue. If we're talking about timetables, the Beijing Olympics begin on February the 4th. Putin is scheduled to go there to meet with Xi Jinping. It'll be their first in-person meeting for, you know, since COVID hit. And I don't think the Chinese would be very happy if a war breaks out just at the beginning of the Olympics, which is a great showpiece for them.
Well, I never even considered the Olympics as part of the calculation. Let me read a tweet, and I'll put this to you, Melinda Herring. A listener tweeted at us, Putin is proving to smaller European countries why they need to join NATO and have U.S., U.K., EU troops stationed inside them. I mean, that would be sort of a reverse of what Putin wants. But what do you think of that?
I think your listener nailed it. And Angela said this before, the irony of Putin's aggression in Ukraine is that more Ukrainians want to join NATO than ever before, and more of Eastern Europe wants to be part of NATO. And it's given NATO a new life and a new mission. So that's the irony of all this. Vladimir Putin must not like that reality. You know, we may see two more countries join NATO as a result of this aggression in Europe as well.
And why does Putin fear NATO so much?
So I think this is a boogeyman, to be honest. He shouts and screams about NATO. But like Angela said, if we're really honest and you talk to experts on NATO, they will say that Ukraine could not join NATO in the next 10 years if it were the most studious student ever and did everything correct. There's a lot that Ukraine has to do in order to be eligible for NATO membership. So it's fake. When Putin says that NATO is encircling him, he's justifying his aggression to the Russian people. That's what this is about.
And what's the chance that there might be some kind of an accident or a misunderstanding or a misstep that would lead to a really, if not all out war, you know, something that's a lot closer to war than some of the skirmishes that we have seen in parts of Europe?
I do think this is a real possibility. And just to add to what Melinda said, I believe it's 16.16% of Russian territory borders on NATO. So to say that Russia's surrounded by NATO is pretty amusing. Unfortunately, you know, if you go back to World War I, you know, how that broke out, if you look at other conflicts, with this huge Russian military buildup on three sides, as Melinda has said, and now with the Ukrainians themselves getting more arms, you've got joint Russian-Belarusian military exercises also on the border, the possibility for some unforeseen incident grows all the time. We also know that the Russians, you know, what they did in Georgia in 2008 was to essentially provoke the then President Saakashvili into firing back and then having this short war where Russia took some territory from Georgia. And so, you know, they could be also trying to provoke some Ukrainians to do something foolish, if you like, and then use that as an excuse to start a war. But I think we do have to be concerned about that.
Here's an email from Michael. I'm a Ukrainian American. I have a vested interest in making sure Ukraine remains free of Russian interference. The UK and the US have a moral, maybe legal, obligation to provide security assurances through the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances signed in 1994. Melinda, do you agree with Michael?
He's right, but unfortunately, citing Budapest doesn't get you a hot dog or a Coke today. Unfortunately, you know, we broke our word, And there's a lot of different ways to say there were security assurances, not security guarantees. Diplomats have sort of clever ways of trying to say we haven't broken our word. The reality is we did break our word. But citing that doesn't get you anything in Washington. So I really wouldn't focus on it. I would say one other point, though, on diplomacy, Angela's right. Yes, we need to keep talking to Lavrov and Putin and doing these rounds of diplomacy. But diplomacy's on life support. And we fundamentally, Washington and Moscow fundamentally disagree about Europe and about the world. Moscow says that NATO cannot expand full stop. And NATO says, yes, we can. We determine who is a NATO membership in NATO, not you. And Washington says the same thing. No American president could ever say yes to Putin's demands. And Biden knows, too, that he has to get Ukraine right. After the big muck-up in Afghanistan, Biden is really weak right now. Angela said he personally cares a lot about Ukraine. Yes. But the shrewd, cynical part of me says he has to get it right politically. This is a midterm year. The economy's not doing that great. COVID hasn't recovered. He can't afford another big foreign policy screw up. So that's another reason why I think Biden is really invested in Ukraine now.
And getting it right, is that getting Russia to back down and remove its troops?
Absolutely. It's getting the Russians to de-escalate. I mean, the best case scenario is the status quo, that Ukraine remains where it is territorially. I mean, and Russia goes back to its barracks. That is the best case scenario. Of course, it's terrible that Russia still, you know, has falsely annexed Crimea, and Ukraine needs to fight to get that back. I don't mean fight with arms, right, but continue to raise awareness that Crimea is Ukraine, and then 7% of East of the Donbass is under the control of Russian backed thugs, and you know, Ukraine is going to continue to hold the line there, and hopefully that territory will come back to Ukraine in the not too distant future.
I mean, Angela, are we seeing a version of the Cold War playing out?
It looks very much like it. We just don't want it to be a hot war. I mean, we're back to thinking, how can we contain Russia, i.e. prevent it from expanding territorially and dominating its neighborhood and beyond. And that's what Putin wants. Putin would like to return to a situation where Russia behaves like the Soviet Union does, and it really has a veto right over the choices of its neighbors in the area to do what they want. You know, Putin believes that there are only a few totally sovereign countries in the world, United States, Russia, China, India, and that all other countries have limited sovereignty. That's just what the Soviets believe, too. Wow. And therefore, they have to listen to what Russia wants.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but I want to put this very quickly to you, Angela Stent. President Biden talks about personal sanctions on Putin. My understanding is he is a billionaire. Is that something that would get his attention?
Well, it certainly would, but you have to understand that you're not going to find bank accounts with his name on it. So this is complicated. It also does raise the question of how many of our European allies would go along with this. And I'm not sure that we know the answer to that yet. But obviously, you know, this would be a major change in policy if it were possible.
If it were possible. Well, we have to leave it there. Angela Stent, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times to talk about such a critical issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Putin's World. Melinda Herring, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Huge pleasure.
You're very welcome. And she's deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And we also talked with Mary Kalina, and she is a Ukrainian-American, talking about the rally this Sunday at the Art Museum in Philadelphia at 2 o'clock. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can find many of our programs there. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.